Jim Packard with you on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you along with us today. Let me give you the telephone number if you'd like to get a question in for our next guest as we talk about Black Hawk and his followers. The number in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, it's 1-800-642-1234. Carrie Trask is a history professor at the UW-Manitowoc and the author of Black Hawk, The Battle for the Heart of America, published by Henry Holt. A native of Canada, Carrie earned his Ph.D. at the University of Minnesota, the author of two previous books, including Fire Within, a Civil War narrative from Wisconsin, which was awarded the Council for Wisconsin Writers Leslie Cross Book-Length Nonfiction Award in 1996. And it's a pleasure to have Carrie Trask on the phone with us today. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, Jim. Good to be back.
Thank you very much. I was reminded by our former state archaeologist Bob Birmingham that this summer marks the 175th anniversary of the various battles in the War of Black Hawk.
Yeah, it sure does. 175 years went by pretty fast.
It did indeed.
And when I was writing the book, I had no notion of that at all. But and in fact, there's been a lot of interest lately, simply because of the anniversary, and so I've been speaking at a number of places and to a variety of groups. And
you also received a nice award this past weekend.
As a matter of fact, I just came back from Iowa.
What was that?
The State Historical Society of Iowa gave me, or at least gave the book, the Benjamin S. Shambo Award, which is for an outstanding book dealing with the history of Iowa. Published during the previous year. So it was pretty heady. It was a pretty heady event for me, and I really appreciated it a lot. And I think, again, it sort of indicates the interest there is in the subject.
If we could go back in time to the year 1832 and meet Black Hawk, what would he look like to us?
Black Hawk would look nothing like the statues and the monuments that have been put up to him. Black Hawk was a man in 1832 who was at least 65, maybe older, certainly in his mid-60s, and he was a man whose best years clearly seemed to be behind him. He was short. He was thin. He was even frail. He was a man that just didn't have those sort of heroic proportions that you would expect of a powerful and charismatic leader. And the other aspects of Black Hawk, which may be surprising, is he was known to be a pretty unaccomplished orator and was not a man of inspiring and moving words and had no position of any authority, any formal authority within the Sauk tribe. So the mystery about Black Hawk is like, wow, a man who is so unimpressive in terms of his physical presence and in terms of his position. Why did he have such an impact upon the people of his own society?
A very good question.
Well, I think I have an answer. The period from 1822 on, up until 1822, the Sauk people who lived near the confluence of the Rock and the Mississippi Rivers, and there had a very large summertime settlement known as Sauconuk. Sauconuk was in fact the largest human settlement in the upper Mississippi region. It was bigger than Chicago, it was bigger than St. Louis. It contained maybe between 6,000 and 7,000 people when everybody was home for the summer. And summer really began in mid-April and lasted until the end of October. And then after the end of October, people went west to engage in the winter hunt, which was a major part of the fur trade economy. But up until 1822, everything went well for these people. In fact, contrary to a lot of assumptions in American society, the Sauk and many of the tribes, in fact, in western Wisconsin, were not the vanishing Americans. Indeed, their numbers were increasing. Their prosperity was growing. Their economy was becoming more diverse and productive. And these were people who lived, you know, lived very well beyond the level of starvation. People who lived very comfortable and pretty complex lives in ways, in cultural ways. And then in 1832, it almost came to an end abruptly when the lead rush began. There was not a discovery of lead, but because the natives themselves were lead miners, and that was a part of their economy.
Mm-hmm.
But all of a sudden, you know, there was urbanization in the East, and there was an increased demand for lead for paint, for plumbing, for pipes, for all kinds of needs in a growing urban society. And all of a sudden, the knowledge that there was lead in the Upper Mississippi Valley led to a lead rush, which was very much like a gold rush, and people started to swarm in large numbers, caring very little about the interests of the native people living there. People with dreams of wealth and power, people who were on the hustle, and all of a sudden a rhythmic way of life was all of a sudden like plunged into a kind of confusion and chaos. And at the same time, the American Fur Company, which was the company of John Jacob Astor, moved in. And for Astor and the American Fur Company, the bottom line was all that counted. So the old paternalistic relationships that had persisted for a long time between fur traders and native hunters, well, that was gone. You know, the rhetoric changed, the operations changed, the whole motivation of the fur trade changed. And not only were the Sauk and the Fox and the Winnebago and other groups in the area overrun by people looking for lead, but the operations of the American Fur Company began a process that quickly drove the fur-bearing animals to the point of extinction, and thereby reduced the native people to a condition of impoverishment.
I understand that Sauk-a-Nuck, which was the thriving largest Indian village, was wiped out after they threw in with the British in the French Indian War.
Well, the Sauk had thrown in with the British not only during the French and Indian War, but also during the War of 1812, and there was a fair amount of action in Wisconsin and the Upper Mississippi region during the War of 1812, and the Sauk were involved. And then the Sauk also went as far as Detroit to be supporting forces for the British there. And then when the war was over, Sauk-a-Nuck was not wiped out, but even though there was an attempt by William Clark, who was of course famous from the Lewis and Clark expedition.
Mm-hmm.
William Clark was the superintendent of Indian Affairs at the time in St. Louis, and was in fact superintendent of Indian Affairs all the way through the Black Hawk War in 1832. And there was an attempt to attack Sauk-a-Nuck, but the Sauk themselves drove back an American force that was led by Zachary Taylor and William Clark, and the fact is that even in Prairie du Chien, the British with native support took Prairie du Chien away from the Americans as well. So on this side of the War of 1812, it was a victory for the native tribal people and the British. But then, of course, the British at the end of the war dumped the Indians and kind of reconsolidated their position and moved on from there. So the Sauk were always suspect because of this question of loyalty, because of their Because not only had they fought with the British in the War of 1812, but they continued, a large number of them continued to make an annual trip all the way from Saconuc, all the way in western part of Illinois, all the way to what is now Windsor, Ontario, to visit with the British in the summer, to receive gifts from the British, to trade with them. And so there was a really ongoing suspicion of British motives, and of the British manipulation, as it was thought, of the native people. So the Sauk were people who were suspected by American authorities.
Our guest is Kerry Trask, the author of Black Hawk: The Battle for the Heart of America, published by Henry Holt. This is the 175th anniversary year of the Battle of Black Hawk and the Black Hawk War. And we'll be talking about that with Kerry for the next half hour. And if you'd like to join the conversation, the telephone number in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. I don't know whether you've ever had a chance to stop and see the Black Hawk Memorial, which exists outside of Sauk City, Wisconsin. But I was looking at Dennis McCann's Takes You for a Ride, Stories from the Byways of Iowa, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Illinois, and he reprints a picture of the plaque of the Battle of Wisconsin Heights. And on July 21st, 1832, during a persistent rainstorm, the 65-year-old Sauk Indian leader Black Hawk and 60 of his Sac and Fox and Kickapoo warriors in a holding action against 700 United States militia at this location. You've been there before, I'm positive, Kerry.
I have been. I've read Dennis's articles, too.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a battle there, and it was a confrontation between two men who become legends. The leader of the militia was Henry Dodge, who, of course, becomes the first territorial governor of Wisconsin, and then goes on to become the first United States senator from Wisconsin. And the confrontation is between Henry Dodge, a man who's in his early 50s at the time, who's really on the rise to political fame and political power, and is really promoting his career by being this fearless leader against the savages, this fearless Indian fighter, and thereby emulating, of course, the example of Andrew Jackson. And of course, the other legend is Black Hawk, and this confrontation happens late in the afternoon, in midsummer, during a rainstorm. It's getting dark, and what happens is the native warriors, even though they do suffer about 60 men lost, and while Dodge only loses one, nevertheless, what happens is the native warriors hold off the attack, the American attack, while the women and the children and the old people and are able to make their way about a mile through the forest to make their way to the Wisconsin River and get across before it becomes dark, and thereby escape what certainly would have been a slaughter at that point. And among people who made observations on that was Jefferson Davis, who was a young lieutenant, pretty fresh out of West Point at the time, who was stationed at Portage. And when he became aware of what Black Hawk had done, he was just amazed at the skill of the maneuver protect women and children, and at the same time hold off a major military force that was aggressively moving towards it, and handle a retreat in a rainstorm across a river with women and children. And in fact, the Battle of Wisconsin Heights is a loss for the Indians in many ways, but it's also a little like Dunkirk, I guess, for the British in World War II. It's a loss that also is a moral victory, because they get away. They get themselves not only across the broad Wisconsin River, but they managed to get themselves off into the forest and into the hills of western Wisconsin and really feel confident about escaping that way.
Need to break in because we're going to pause for an update on the latest news, and when we come back, we'll talk about what happened then to Black Hawk and his followers in the days that followed that event. And also, we'll talk about the situation in the country leading in, because there was a lot of turmoil, social turmoil in the country at the time. But we'll be back with a look of Black Hawk in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. Hi, Jim Packard in for Larry Mueller today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you along with us as we continue to talk with Professor Kerry Trask about his book on Black Hawk and his followers. The book is called Black Hawk, The Battle for the Heart of America. It's published by Henry Holt. And again, Kerry, thank you very much for spending time with us today.
Oh, it's great to be with you, Jim.
We talked about the specific battle of Black Hawk in Wisconsin, but that was not the end of Black Hawk and his band at that time. It occurred a few days later, did it not?
Yeah. The Battle of Wisconsin Heights is, of course, a very important incident in the war, and it's very, very important in the career of Henry Dodge. But what happens after that is the SOC, led by Black Hawk and the Winnebago Prophet, make their way through western Wisconsin and reach the banks of the Mississippi River. They reach the bank of the Mississippi River on the last day of July. And on August 1st, they attempt to cross the river. But just as they're getting together rafts and makeshift canoes, a steamboat called the Warrior, heading down from Fort Snelling, which is course, now within the area of the Twin Cities, sees them and pulls in fairly close to shore and opens up on them with cannon fire, and so they fall back and then prepare to try to make their escape across the Mississippi the following day. And that night, unknown to them, was a large force of perhaps 1,400 to 1,500 troops. Henry Atkinson with the regular army, also with Zachary Taylor, and Henry Dodge's troops and the Illinois militia, all arise from their camp at 2 o'clock in the morning and make their way through the countryside of western Wisconsin. And shortly after dawn, begin coming through the trees and begin to descend the bluff along the Mississippi River to catch the Sauk, caught between themselves and the river. And there occurs a quote unquote a battle. Really, truly, is a massacre.
Massacre.
And it happens in the morning of August the 2nd, and it's known as the Battle of Bad Axe because it's in a position along the Mississippi River about a mile and a half south of where the Bad Axe River flows into the Mississippi, and the killing and the clubbing and the mutilations go on throughout the morning, and there were about 1,600 people that followed Black Hawk out of Iowa across the Mississippi in April of 1832 in that spring. And even after the Battle of Wisconsin Heights, there still may have been about a thousand people who were left who continued on with Black Hawk across to the Mississippi. And by noon, or shortly thereafter, on August the 2nd, after the smoke clears and the killing ceases, the American forces managed to round up only 39 survivors, all of whom are women and young children. Some people, maybe as many as 150, had made it across the river, but many of those who had attempted to do that were intercepted by the Warrior, the steamboat that had come back up from Prairie du Chien in the morning. And the river, the Mississippi River, was just absolutely floating with dead people and dead horses, and the river, in fact, was changing color as a result of the bleeding of people. So it was just the horror, the the horror, as Kurt says in the Heart of Darkness. I mean, it was just one of these great spasms of terror and kind of bloodlust and madness that happens. And of course, the Indians pay the horrendous price for that.
Let's take some calls. We thank people who've been waiting patiently here, including Tim in Fenimore. Hi, Tim. Tim, are you there? Apparently not.
Tim is not there.
No. Let's go to Ellen next in Waukesha. Hi, Ellen.
Hi.
What can we do for you today?
Well, I want to say hi to Kerry and congratulate him on his award and the narrative of Blackhoff, which is a book I've enjoyed and used in courses. It was apparently taken down, I understand, in St. Louis, and I wanted to ask Kerry, when he went to St. Louis in prison, was that because William Clark was based there, or why? I've always wondered why.
But you're talking about Black Hawk's own autobiography.
Yes.
And it was not taken down in St. Louis. It was taken down in Fort Armstrong, which was on Rock Island at the time, and it was taken down by a man who was a mountain of a man. I mean, he was just a huge man. He was the Indian interpreter at Fort Armstrong, and LeClaire was his name, and he Anton LeClaire, and he was very fluent in a number of Indian languages, and he took it down. The very famous autobiography of Black Elk, who was a Plains Indian, was very popular in the 60s and 70s. And this is very much the same kind of process that Black Hawk came in. He sat down and, you know, for more than a day, you know, dictated his life story, and LeClaire took it down. And then a man by the name of Patterson, John Patterson, who was a newspaper editor, edited it up and embellished it somewhat, and it was published and became instantaneously one of the best sellers of the early 19th century. And it really ranks with other real famous narratives, such as Frederick Douglass, the slave who wrote a narrative of his life.
Mm-hmm.
They both hold the same appeal, pretty much the same kind of reading audience. And Black Hawk, through his autobiography, becomes the most famous Indian in America. And what we have as a result of that is we really truly have, for the first time, in a very dramatic and a very detailed way, the Indian side of another of these, you know, terrible Indian wars. So it's a reliable source. Of course, you can tell where it's been embellished by Patterson. And a new edition of that is coming out. A professor of English literature, of American literature at Louisiana State University, a man by the name of Gerald Kennedy, has written a very good new introduction to a new edition of Black Hawk's Life, which will be published by Penguin.
Hmm.
Great. Well, just one last quick question. Was he ever in, I understood he was in jail at one point in St. Louis. So
he was. He was in jail. He was a prisoner at Jefferson Barracks, which was just then south of St. Louis. And after that, was taken with a number of his followers, and put in prison in Fort Monroe in Virginia. And in between the trip from St. Louis to Fort Monroe, he had an audience with President Andrew Jackson. So yeah, he was in prison in St. Louis.
Ellen, thank you very much for your call and your questions. We appreciate hearing from you. If you'd like to add to the conversation with a question or comment, the number in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, we're toll-free at 800-642-1234. Our guest is Kerry Trask, the author of Black Hawk. And let's go to Ron next in Madison. Hi, Ron.
Thanks, Dr. Trask. I count Black Hawk as a great real American, and I wondered how you, as a historian who've studied the facts and kind of sorted out the embellishments and stuff, how you would rate him compared to other historical figures from American history. I should explain, I believe there are three kinds of Americans real Americans like Black Hawk and Sacagawea and Sequoia, their ancestors were already on these two continents and islands in 1491. And the third type are us recent Americans whose ancestors arrived after 1491. But I wondered how you would, how you would rate Black Hawk as a historical figure. How great was he compared to other people?
Well, it's a good question. I think, the context of your question is a good one, too, because it deals with the definition of what a real American is. And I think that really is at the heart of the battle for the heart of America. It's one of the themes I take up, and certainly one of the arguments I make in the book, that, boy, this is a story about identity and about really who really has just claim to the continent and who really is an American. But as far as Black Hawk is concerned, I think certainly a heroic, tragic figure, who, in my work, my study of him, I do see him as a very human figure, who has his failings, but also has some very, very, very impressive strengths. And for a man his age, and for a man who really becomes a leader because of what he stands for, what he embodies, what he becomes a symbol, which is a compelling symbol for these people, and therefore he has this large following. I do think that he is certainly a great person, a man of real perseverance, very, very dedicated to the old values, very concerned about the well-being of his own people, but also, in the big picture, concerned about the survival of a culture, which to him really defines the essence of being a human being, and being courageous and really, really risking it all for that. I think, certainly if Beschloff was doing a new book, not just on presidential courage, but was doing a book on courage, I think Black Hawk would have to be one of the figures in such a book.
Ron, thanks very much. We appreciate your call. Let's go to Jim next in La Crosse. Jim, what's on your mind today?
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Great program, by the way. I had heard a rumor that there was a significant Army payroll that had been buried in the bluffs, either at the Battle of Wisconsin Heights or the Battle of Bad Axe. So I was wondering if there was any validity to that tale.
Gosh,
I'll take my answer off the air. Hang on.
What an interesting idea. I mean, the Black Hawk War is just this sort of the source of all kinds of interesting local legends.
Mm-hmm.
But honestly, I don't know. I don't know a thing about that, and I would really doubt whether any kind of Army payroll would survive any attempt to hide it. Somebody certainly would have walked off with it. But it's an interesting idea. I hadn't heard, and I certainly can't speak to the validity of it.
Jim, thanks very much for your call. Another Jim in Menominee is next. Hi, Jim. Oh, I guess I have to push the button in order to get you on. Hi, Jim.
Hello.
Yes.
I was curious to know, I've read about Tecumseh, the Shawnee leader, and his effort to put together a federation of various tribes. And I know that he had traveled, according to Bill Gilbert's book, I know that he had traveled to the Four Lakes region, which is the Madison area. And although he died, I think, in 1815, I was wondering if he had ever attempted to form a federation with Black Hawk.
Oh, well, Black Hawk was Black Hawk certainly was aware of Tecumseh, and he was aware of Tecumseh's brother Tenskwatawa, who was a very, very powerful prophet, Shawnee prophet, whose religious vision had tremendous influence, not only as far up as the Four Lakes, the area of Madison, but all the way up into the Ojibwe camps in northern Wisconsin. And, yeah, Black Hawk was very well aware of Tecumseh. And Tecumseh dies in the Battle of the Thames in southwestern Ontario in the summer of 1813. And I think very much that Black Hawk was influenced by Tecumseh's example. And Tecumseh had pulled together a pretty effective Confederacy. Black Hawk tries to do the same thing. And there are Sauk diplomats who go as far away as Texas and Louisiana and attempts to bring other tribal groups into a very large alliance system that will stop American expansion. It doesn't work in his case. And it doesn't work, I think, because in Tecumseh's case, there was the religious dimension to the movement. And in Black Hawk's case, there wasn't. I mean, there was just the cultural.
But there is evidence that Tecumseh did travel into northern Wisconsin.
Yes, he did. There's absolutely that's correct. He did travel into northern Wisconsin.
Okay.
And in fact, had large support from Winnebago, now known as the Ho-Chunk. Tecumseh has a large support from the Ho-Chunk.
Jim, thanks very much. We appreciate hearing from you. If you'd like to get a comment or a question in, the number in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, toll free at 800-642-1234. Let's go to David next in Ridgeway. Hi, David.
Hi. I had a question about Henry Dodge. How old a person was he during that battle?
Henry Dodge is 50.
He was 50.
And as far as we can tell, he was 50. He may have been a year older than that. But Dodge was real deceptive in that way, and that people who saw him and wrote comments about meeting him, all judged his age to be at least 10 or 15 years younger. I mean, Dodge was in great shape. He had a full head of hair. He had, depending on when you caught him, he had a full beard and. He dressed the part. He dressed in a buckskin hunting jacket. And
would he have been the same? Was he a colonel?
Well, Dodge had been a general in the militia when he lived in Missouri, and then he moved up first of all to Galena, Illinois, in 1831, and became a colonel in the Illinois militia at Galena. But then in the winter of 31-32, he moved up into what now is Wisconsin. It was then the Michigan Territory. And struck it rich big time with the discovery of a lead deposit in what now is Dodgeville. And Dodge was only ranked as a colonel in the Michigan Territorial Militia. But he does go on afterwards, you know, to serve some time with the regular Army of the United States. Dodge is a man with a great military reputation. And
I had read a biography on Kit Carson a while back, and there was a Henry Dodge who in the 1850s was an Indian agent for the Navajos. Would this have been the same Henry Dodge?
I don't know. I doubt it. I know Dodge had one son who ended up in the United States Senate. I don't know if he had a second son.
Yeah, this man's name was...
What, did you read Blood and Thunder? Is that the book you read?
Yes.
Yeah, that's quite a good book.
And it was, I believe it was Henry Lynn Dodge.
Boy, I don't know. I couldn't tell you. Could be, but honestly, I couldn't say.
David, thanks very much for the inquiry. Harlan DeForest, let's give you a chance. Hello, Harlan.
Hello. I just want to make mention that I was a member of the 86th Infantry Black Hawk Division, World War II.
Wow.
So it probably came up from this program you have now. We were in the Battle of the Bulge, World War II, and we came back to the States, and we went over to the Philippines in our second trip overseas. So I just...
Yeah, that's very interesting. I think, the what's ironic about all of this is, of course, we the people who were, you know, whose ancestors were doing the killing at the Battle of Bad Axe. Of course, we've appropriated Black Hawk as a symbol for ourselves, and of course, there's the there's the Chicago Blackhawks, and there's the Blackhawk Country Club, and there's, you know, there's all kinds of Blackhawk parks and even counties and savings and loans. And but I think the, you know, Jim asked me early in the show why I thought Blackhawk emerges as a leader, and of course I babbled on and never really answered. But you know, Blackhawk really does emerge as a symbol of, geez, what, you know, for the Sauk, he becomes a symbol of what a Sauk man ought to be. And I think in many ways he becomes the figure, a figure in the American collective memory of, geez, an admirable person who really stood up for what was important in his culture. So I think in some ways the appropriation of Blackhawk's name is, you know, maybe questionable as high school mascots, but I understand why it's done.
Thanks very much for the call, and let's give the last word to Jack in Waukesha. Hi, Jack.
Hi. Have you ever heard of another famous person in history who was apparently in the Illinois militia, lost his horse on the a little west of Waukesha here on his way back to Illinois?
Right. Abraham Lincoln, right?
And that's what I was looking for.
Yeah, Abraham Lincoln. I mean, it is a war where it's just overflowing with famous people, or people who will become famous, like Jefferson Davis and Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln was a captain, was elected the captain of a company from New Salem, Illinois. And in years after, said, boy, he just, you know, there was never an election that he had more satisfaction in winning than the election as captain of his infantry company. Actually, it was a cavalry company. Abraham Lincoln was 23 years old at the time, and but then, of course, you know, Zachary Taylor, who becomes president of the United States, and Lewis Cass, who tries to become president of the United States, and Winfield Scott, who runs for the presidency of the United States. They're all also involved in the war, including Robert Anderson, who is the man who's in command of Fort Sumter the day that the Confederates fired upon it in the harbor of Charleston, South Carolina. So yeah, there's a lot of people who go on to bigger and better things, which is a real indication that the United States was a small society in the early 19th century.
Jack, thank you very much for your call, and Carrie, thank you so much for spending time with us again today. What's your next book?
Well, my next book is a book about an Arctic explorer. Boy, talk about, you know, moving around, huh?
Yes.
The man's name was Elisha Kane, and he was from Philadelphia, and he was an Arctic explorer in the 1850s.
And when it comes out, I hope that you'll come and talk with us again.
I hope I have.
Thanks a lot. Carrie Trask, history professor at the UW-Manitowoc. The book is Black Hawk, The Battle for the Heart of America. It's published by Henry Holt. Coming tomorrow, cicadas and honeybees with Phil Pelletieri, our entomologist at the UW-Madison and UW Extension. Hope you're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.